This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
This week's This Life with Dr. Bob Forrest is courtesy of Bergamet Sport, an all-natural athletic performance-enhancing and muscle recovery supplement with the usual multiple cardiovascular benefits associated with the polyphenols in the Bergamet products. Hey, this is Dr. Drew, and you are listening to This Life
with Bob Forrest
and Dr. Drew.
Here we are.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, gather around the iPhone for another adventure of This Life with Dr. Drew and Bob Forrest.
You feel pretty good today, Bob. You all right? Everything good?
I feel great.
All right, I feel great. Saw a little negative stuff in your Facebook post.
No. When kids die, I get bummed out.
Imagine that. You know. We'll remind everyone that we are brought to you courtesy of Bergamet, Bergamet Sport now. We'll tell you about that. The First Lady of Love, Miss Susan Pinsky, is on Bergamet now and has had a very nice response to that. It's great to see the whole family.
How do you know you have a nice response to it? Because I want to get on it. I'm done with Harvoni treatment, so I can get on it now.
Yeah, yeah. You would be good.
I want to get on it. And I'll notice.
Yeah.
How much of his placebo effect?
No. It's like a weak HMG CoA reductase inhibitor.
Remember,
you want to get a mic and tell us?
Remember when I was on Harvoni, you told me
you were manic on Harvoni. That was a different thing. But go ahead, Susan.
Well, hopefully that'll happen on this.
Yeah, blood pressure went down.
To.
Bergamot will do.
And it had some of you took in the female one, the fat one.
Yeah, I'm taking the one that has a testosterone enhancer. So
I might need that.
So I had less hot flashes this month.
Yeah.
I mean, it prolonged my hormone replacement therapy.
Yeah,
it was good. It worked.
Excellent.
I want it.
All right, let's talk about National Assessment Foundation.
Okay, the National Assessment.
Let me give the phone number first. It's 888-494-9186. Tell everybody what it is.
It's a place you can call when you have no hope and nowhere to go. And whether you have insurance or not insurance, it's the National Assessment Foundation. It delivers hope, offering support, education, direction, and connecting individuals with their resources. Because most people, Drew, don't even know where they can go, right?
Yeah.
They don't even know. And what you do, here's the newest thing I learned from NAF, the people that work there. Do you know that when I used to always tell people, just call the back of your insurance card. They'll tell you where you can go to treatment, right?
Right.
Do you know that they send you to the cheapest treatment?
Of course.
I didn't know that. Why didn't you tell me that? I've been telling people that for decades.
It's not just what is covered, and what is covered is usually not.
But you're entitled to a lot more benefits. The insurance company is not going to tell you.
That's very often the case. But tell them, what's the National Assessment Foundation?
So the National Assessment Foundation is a 1-800 number, a call center.
888 number.
Yeah, an 888 number you can call. And they'll engage the addicts and tell them about resources in their community if they don't have insurance.
Now, that's the reason we dig these guys.
Yeah.
Because they aren't just
referrals. Because most people don't have good insurance.
Right. So it's not just people getting referrals to good programs with insurance. They're following up and making sure they get into those programs, which is we like that, number one.
Yeah.
And then number two, people that don't have insurance, they will make sure those people find something like Salvation Army or something and follow them until they do what they need to do.
And keep being a connection that they have in this cesspool of a world of recovery.
Nice.
Right?
Yes.
It's true.
But and you've also talked to the assessors, and they're all recovering people.
One of them's a client of mine.
Oh, interesting. Yeah. So we can sign off. 888-494-9186. We appreciate what these guys do, and we can support them. And we appreciate them and Bergamet being supportive of this podcast. And even more so, we're pleased to welcome Battlefield Addiction as our guest of This Life podcast today.
I've been waiting a week for this. I'm excited.
Art Dahlin, Angie Keady. We're joined also by Amy Brooks. This was all in response to something awful. So tell us about this, guys. Welcome.
Tell us
about the family first approach.
First about the epidemic in Seattle. I mean, that's really it all begins at ground zero, right?
Yeah, we got involved in sober living approximately 5 years ago, Amy and I. And we lost our first client on a December night. I came to the... We got to one of the house looking for one of the clients, and nobody knew who he was, so I went up in his room and I actually found a client had overdosed in one of our houses, and I'd never met his family. I'd never understood that side of it. And his parents came over that night. And
how heavy is that, Drew?
I've been there many times.
And that's when I met him, above standing above a gentleman named Blake's body bag. And that's where I vowed to myself that I can't really do anything until we have the family involved. And it wasn't like a little bit. It's like everything. So for us, we determined that we weren't going to move forward with people unless it was impossible, we were going to have their family involved. So, you know, that started years ago, but it didn't really kick off until I met Angie and took her kid in.
Talk to us about that.
Well, I can share about that. When I met Art 3 years ago, he took my son in about 1 o'clock in the morning, and my son wasn't ready for help at the time. He really was looking for a warm, dry place to sleep for the night. Mm-hmm. Meeting Art that night really gave me two things. Number one, it gave my son a lighthouse, somewhere to go when he really was ready for help. So the next time he came, it was maybe for a couple days, and the next time it was for a week, and then longer. But more importantly, really what it gave to me was a coach in this process. I had already been in this battle with my son for about six years at that point.
Wow. Were you going to Al-Anon?
I did go to a few meetings.
But you don't have a sponsor or we're going to program or anything?
No, not me personally, no. We went to several treatment centers, several counselors for years, and I was just lost. For the first time, I found somebody to tell me exactly what to do. Things like, Mom, take your power back. Mom, he's lying to you. Mom, this is what you need to do. And I started doing what he told me to do.
The hard part for the moms is, we've talked over many years, is that every addict, the disease invokes in every mom the fantasy that if the mom doesn't continue to intervene...
They'll die.
Slash enable. The child will die. That's the fantasy that the disease always evokes in the mind of the mom. Right. Like, this kid's going to die if I don't... I got to save. And the disease, of course, takes full advantage of that.
And slowly, with the change in our culture, I find that the dads more have that these days.
Really?
It's crazy.
Wow.
Right? The moms I've been dealing with the last 2 or 3 or 4 years are pretty... know what's going on, right? And know that the kid's lying to them. The dads believe the lies.
Is that because the dads have a fantasy about returning to a, you know, full thriving life instantly,
or
is
that have that belief,
or is it because dad has not been really participating in the treatment?
Because the dads were absent, maybe out making money, and this is a way of relieving their guilt in this modern.
Well, but women are just about as likely to be out there earning money too, or maybe doubling down, earning money and having to deal with the family.
But let's talk about that too, because. Both parents are working, right?
Yeah.
But moms are still involved in the children's upbringing and raising, but dads aren't.
Right, okay.
Dads get to opt out because, isn't that kind of what's going on up there?
Well, I mean, I think for me it was completely different. For me, I was in a space of thinking I was doing the right thing by letting him just wait for him to hit bottom. We were just at our wits' end. So I was, we've done everything we can do, and I didn't know what to do. So I was in that space.
Yeah, Angie, when I met Angie, there was no enabling really to be found in her family, with the exception of some of the uncles and some of his uncles and other family members. So he was just a kid that could make it on the streets. And so we had to take a different approach with him and actually find, there was times where we had to go out on the streets and actually find Devin and bring him home. It wasn't anybody. You know, and they were done with it. They were ready to have a solution. Her and her husband Tim, they were ready for it.
So why is that? Because I know the Portland area more. I know it's in Seattle too. There's the railer kids, and I try to talk to them at my friend's place in Hollywood. They all kind of ride the rails, they hitchhike, they get around, and they seem to function at that low level, street level of society. What's wrong with that? Just let them do that. I don't understand. I really don't understand.
That's what you used to do.
I lived there for years. Yeah. Why is it that, and my family was able to disconnect completely, trust me.
So you're saying that's a good thing?
I'm saying that how are you going to change them? Well, treatment's not going to change them.
Well, that's what I learned through art, is I learned that there is actually something that I can do, and I need to, or I'm going to lose him. And so, Mom, there is some power. Take your power back. There are action steps to take, and thank God I listened.
Do you have guidelines?
Right. Well, every case is totally different. I mean, we don't find any case the same. And he asked why you don't do that. And I think that's the simple reason is because it's the stakes have been raised to a level where I've went to too many funerals. I'm just kind of tired of it. And we get too many parents that are just that think they're hopeless. And we have too many miracles. We don't. We are finding extreme situations that parents come to us 7 years, their kids on the street, 6 years, 5 years, or whatever, and they're hopeless. And with a few strategies that we apply.
But then who takes credit for the success? See, I think it's very dangerous for the treatment professionals to take responsibility for the success. I think it might have happened naturally anyways without any involvement right. from you. I've seen that hundreds of times. Mm-hmm. There is a pathway to freedom that parents, they're adults. They're 26 and 24 and 22 years old, and we're still treating them like they're 13 and 14. That's what I don't like about the whole system of it.
I think you're really
expecting if I do something or say something or withhold something I will get the outcome I want. And that's a very dangerous thing because you might follow somebody's direction and your kid might die. And then what? Do you know what I mean?
I don't know if necessarily we're dealing with the same type of addict. I mean, these heroin epidemic addicts,
the
heroin epidemic addicts that we're dealing with up in, and when I speak, I'm mainly, every time I speak, I'm speaking of the 18 to 26 year old heroin addict that is fully seems to be a victim of this opiate epidemic and the fire hose of opiates that have been put on the community. And I'm talking to you about not the addict like me. I'm talking about an addict like this kid was in the band. This kid was like, you know, just a normal high school band kid that I wouldn't have seen an addict when I was in high school with. I think there's a direct distinction between these types of addict. Her son was an old school addict. And you know, of course, you're going to find out later we lost her son. But, you know, her son was an old school addict that just could function and manage a habit and make his way. And I know what you're talking about by that kind of letting life teach these kids lessons, and I get
that. Because
I
don't know where they're going to get the hope. I deal with millennials primarily.
Yeah,
hundreds of them every week. They don't have any hope. That the reason why they don't have any hope is because adults are telling them this country sucks, this world sucks, mm-hmm. everything sucks. Social media reinforces that division and hatred of one another, and that there's. I was talking with a millennial, Johnny, right here, works with me. He doesn't think life sucks. He's not brainwashed by society and media that there's no hope.
But I bet he went through periods where you wonder because the echo chamber is so negative.
So when I meet with these kids, they really believe they're not going to ever have a life worth living. Mm-hmm. And that's why opiates fit them so well, because they have no hope. That is a typical millennial. If you're talking about your son was an older, atypical junkie addict, that's sad because most of those people, in my experience, get sober.
Did he go on replacement at any time, just out of curiosity, like Suboxone or Methadone or anything?
No.
Did he? You sure? Because most of them find their way to that at some point.
No, he never did. On this last round, he went to detox for 7 days, and then he was going to get the Vivitrol shot.
Mm.
But he never did, and he was gone 28 days later.
That's so sad.
But I think, Bob, there's a much more organic thing that we're doing in a dismantling of their addiction where it's not doing something or saying something. It's just a complete dismantle in making sure that the family has no part in it. And then after that, after we've made sure that the family all across the board has, and we don't have any holes, and we know for sure that the family is doing the right thing, and they don't have any part in enabling the addiction or letting them do it, that's where we're getting a family to. Now when we face that, we find out whether the kid is going to take it further or not. And this organic thing seems to be happening where a lot of the kids that we get, we're absolutely ready for it to be over. And, you know, we have moms that just get them out of these trap house or whatever they get them. And the kids were totally ready for it to be over.
I'm a little confused. So do you coach the families before you get the identified patient?
They have weekly groups.
No, before.
Absolutely.
Before you get the patient.
Absolutely. Most of our clients, in fact, all of our clients, it happens through a process of meeting the family, and we're not in it.
And you do groups with family or individual sessions with them?
We do what's called a consultation, and the families come to our open groups on a Thursday night.
Right.
They hear that there's things that can be done.
These are didactic sort of psychoeducation lectures.
It's something. Just like a 20-minute talk. I open up the meeting with some sort of a lesson about addiction, about what I've learned by treating addicts. And then we do an open share, and families start like just like IOP for families. Is basically exactly what it is.
They start supporting each other.
And they start going to back channels and supporting each other and reaching out with each other. But we do not allow for problem-focused thinking. We do not allow for everybody to sit around and talk about the problem. We get right on to, well, this is the next step.
Which is what?
Depends on the case. Depends on the case. I mean, it could be as easy as he's in your basement shooting heroin. You need to go tell him to go to treatment or he's got to go. It could be that, or it could be, you know, a lot of things where father is checked out. You asked about the father, and a lot of times the father's checked out, and it's a little girl that wants her attention from her dad, and so we move the mom out and pull the father in. I mean, there's tons of things that we do. And all of it seems to, and so most of our clients then, you know, I see regular interventions, and I see how that's done, but what the problem with that is that this stuff and this behavior can go on after treatment that's still going to spark the addiction again.
This doesn't sound anything different than what we've done for many, many years.
But
is there a difference?
It's because of the desperation, I think, and you're not the only parents, clinicians, groups are popping up all across the United States. It's in reaction to this death rate. So many mothers have lost their children.
It's unbelievable.
It's 60,000.
But they're not dying. Mine don't die of the heroin. They die of the pills that the doctor gives them after they've been off the heroin for a little while.
Oh, wow.
Now
that's
it's a
almost
fentanyl.
Without exception.
Now it's a fentanyl.
You getting that too?
I talked to a kid, Drew, you'll love this. I talked to a kid who OD'd on fentanyl a couple weeks ago. I hate to laugh. I'm sorry, I laugh. It's black humor. But so I asked him, like, dude, what are you fucking thinking? And he goes, well, they only cost $5, so I figured they couldn't be that good. Like,
perfect.
When you got that kind of thinking, like, you hear about Chinese fentanyl being pumped onto the American streets, it's really fentanyl. And the kids don't believe it. And they're cutting the heroin with fentanyl.
I had a colonoscopy, and they gave me fentanyl. I'm very sensitive to fentanyl. I was sick for a week. I was really sick for 3 days afterwards.
Dr. Drew was on fentanyl.
I hate that shit.
But they're buying it for $5, Drew.
Yeah, I know. It's very, very cheap, very, very powerful. I don't understand why the word's not out, because usually, you know.
Because nobody's getting the
word out. Addicts are pretty good pharmacists, usually.
That's another thing. But I think that hope, I don't know, because I know what your main thing, I see the other side of what you're doing with Aloe and everything. It's they get hope. They don't have hope, Drew. There's a lack of hope.
The patient, the family.
Millennials. I don't really
care. But the family
care.
Are hopeless, too.
No, the families get the more hope from our program.
Yeah.
That's where it comes.
You have to believe that you could have a life in order to want to be sober. And I believe millennials don't believe that there is a better life out there.
We've been over this many, many times, you and I, and it's. I know you vividly experience that on a regular basis. I want to mine where they're at with it, but let's go through.
I would say what our parents get is power.
Yeah,
it's not about hope.
I don't think
we're spreading hope.
We're talking about the kids need hope. Yeah. I'm more concerned.
Bob
with
always
kids.
Wants to talk about
and,
the
and we work with families.
I want to hear more about the family.
We're done with the addicts.
We worked very hard with family stuff too, but we were at a hospital, so there was an identified patient,
and
families would and would not participate. You know, it's hard to get them in. How do you first of all enroll and retain your families? Because families, I have literally had families come up to my nose and go, you know, this is not my problem. He's sick, not me. And it's like, oh boy,
we don't get that anymore. Angie is great. I'll let her talk, but Angie is fantastic about this, requiring it, and with her story.
But where do you find the families? I mean, they come looking for help for somebody, and you go, why don't you come in to a group? Just invite them in? Mm-hmm. Or do you tell them, hey, this is a family
it's
disorder?
It's word of mouth.
You start
they
educating
just come.
Them. They come from
they
other families.
They come, and we work through the family. That's our angle.
The family's on drugs, what do you do? What if the mom's taking benzos? What do you do?
We discuss
that with her. I mean, a lot of it is we tell the families all the time. And in a consultation, we ask and dig deep into the family's bad behavior.
Of course.
I mean, you cannot change your
because
kids.
Because the addict will go for the weak link and what he's saying. The point at my mom's loaded all the time.
So what do I always ask, Ange?
Is there anything I don't know?
And what do they have on you? I ask them all the time, what do they got on you?
Mm-hmm.
I ask them all the time.
What
else do they have on you?
What about sexual abuse?
That
what about sexual abuse? Wow.
All of it.
You're getting down to it.
Yeah.
You don't ask about See, that?
Well, Bob, it's not our...
Not the parents directly.
Oh, hell yeah.
Yeah.
You got to do it.
Yeah. It's not our
belief. When they're the abuser?
You got to ask. Is that right? You got to ask. Is there any abuse? Anything you regret? Yeah. Anything that went...
Anything you regret?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
A parent's going to like talk about sexually abusing their kid to you,
Doc. They're not likely to because they know I'm a qualified required reporter.
Yeah.
But I got to ask.
That is down to it. So is that what you do?
Wait, hold on a second. How many times did you see me evaluate a patient where I had to not just ask, but did somebody touch you? Did somebody?
Yeah, they all have. So who did it? That's the parent side of things.
Maybe they have a different story than the addict does. Listen. You and I had a Mr. Adler, and remember how different his story was than his mom's story?
Yeah.
It can be. It's very telling. It's very interesting how, you know, trying to figure out where truth is and who's distorting and what's going on and what the stakes are. And so what do you do if you have mental illness in the family that comes out? Just get them treatment or?
Well, most of our clients across the board, we're dealing with this garden, a lot of garden variety. I mean, we do get mental illness. I don't think we've ever had a mentally ill father or mother that we've been able to identify as the problem right away. Or
see, we deal with sicker folk, you and I.
Okay. We don't excavate that stuff. Yeah. We work on the next right move. We teach families how to take their power back and what action steps to take to push that out.
So how does a mom take their power back? Give me, like, if I'm I'm a dad. I have a 30-year-old, right? So what do you direct me to do if I'm paying a cell phone bill, for instance?
Well, it really depends on the entire situation. So what we do is we work through the family. The best way we can help a family is through a private consultation. When we do a private consultation with a family, we get the entire playing field out on the table.
Financial dependence.
Everything.
All the
important
leveraging points, right?
Yes, exactly.
Sexual abuse history?
We haven't really got that deep into that.
Addicts have been sexually abused.
Or physically. Or both.
Well, a lot of times the mother will come with their guilt. We ask them, what do they feel guilty for? What is the kid going to use? What is the chink in your armor? All that. I mean, we try to get down to all that. And if they don't tell us, then the kid starts using it. We see that that's why the plan's not working. It's because
he might not even overtly use it, but it's there. And they don't trust us because we're aligned with the parents who have not protected the kid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been in that situation more than once, right?
Yeah. Yes.
And Drew's probably best at getting the mom. It's true, getting the mom, Stephen's mom, different moms in a room interfacing with the kid.
Sure.
So that there's this attachment that's formed. That's what I'm into. The addict has to trust somebody. And I don't know how you can be family focused and then establishing trust with the addicts.
Right? That's a great question.
That's the hard thing.
That's tough, but by the way, but if you have the family as a sort of therapeutic force, then they don't have to trust
you.
But
that's just mind-bogglingly
time-consuming. It's difficult. But go ahead. How do you establish a trust when you're aligned with the family?
Well, that's the first thing. I mean, that's the major reason that I don't even really engage in an intervention with an addict. Because most of the addicts that I work with, they don't meet me until further down the road when they've already come through this 2-week or 3-week period of, I hate you for sending me here and you shouldn't have done this. Yeah. And they're through all that. And then I meet them and they're almost ready to thank me. And that's when they get the addicts coming to me and go, thank you for helping my mother and father. Get me here. And then that's when I can begin to work with that. So it's not a case where I'm his enemy, where his addiction is still encompassing him, you know, where it's like still in there and he's mad because he doesn't want it to be away. This is when the addiction is left and he's getting that moment of clarity. And that's how.
Now, I know how people listen and learn from these kinds of conversations. We're going to have to get specific. You're going to have to either give an example that you feel comfortable sharing or some very specific sort of paint up an imaginary scenario. You have mom. That's what Bob was just trying to get you to do, which is I'm a dad. Give us some real specific things you have seen work. From
that other moms other and dads moms can and, practice and listen to the podcast.
Okay. Well, I mean, I can give you our last consultation.
Just but don't do that because that's too close to identifying.
No, I won't name a name. I mean, I think
you had a recent consultation.
We had a recent consultation, and the kid was in the house.
And remember, whomever you're talking about should not be able to identify themselves by this story. So you're gonna have to
So we could, okay, we could be more general. I know
we
what
have
they
a
talk
lot
about.
So yeah, parents, we have so many
nowadays. Nowadays, parents but pay their kids' cell phone bills so they feel like they can get a hold of them. Right?
That's
a fact.
Yeah.
I always say if you're paying their cell phone bill, you're buying them drugs. Because whatever money they're supposed to be saving to have a cell phone, they spend on drugs because you're going to pay their cell phone for worry of getting a hold of them.
What was the last thing we heard where they were giving money from the government or something and buying drugs?
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Was it food stamps or something?
That was an outpatient program, was bringing people down to get food stamps, and then they were turning around and selling the food stamps.
We're in a fight with that anyways, too. No,
but you know what I'm saying? So I always say the economics is your real power.
Well, it's one source of power.
But you got to look at the case. I mean, if we're talking about a 22-year-old girl that's prostituting herself in a hotel room and this mother is hopeless and hasn't contacted the girl in 2 years and the girl is just doing her thing and a $50 cell phone bill does not equal drugs to this girl.
Yeah, yeah.
And so now we have to keep that cell phone on just so we have a line of communication and so that we can work from someplace. And so it differs in every case.
Every case is different.
Well, Angie, give us an example of what you mean by take the power back for the mom. You can talk about yourself or something you've seen. How do moms get their power back?
Myself or another case. Well, for me, you know, as I said, when I met Art, he started coaching me on the phone and telling me what to do.
What do you do?
Find him.
Give me an example. So don't be hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
Be proactive.
Get out there. Find him.
And?
Bring him home.
Okay.
And God, I don't even remember.
Well, with Devin, we were always on the cusp of losing him. He was in the auto hospital. He was ODing. He was falling out in his car. It was close. It was scary. It was always scary. And so we would, you know, I mean, I had her call in a warrant, and he went to jail, and we got him arrested. And she said,
"To me, that you know, that's my big move.
That's what Drew always loves talking about
because that saves lives.
Yeah,
and you couldn't have done that without coaching.
She didn't think it was right. She thought that Devin would never trust her again.
Right.
That's
the fantasy that the disease indoctrinates every mind.
And we got a mom right now, or we got a family right now, where there's all types of families where the kid holds them hostage through. I'm going to kill myself.
Right.
And this is a big one. And to tell that family, you just tell them, listen, until your fear is lower than the fear, you know, until that ratio is down right now, that fear level we have of him committing suicide is so high that he's got us hostage. And only when our fear diminishes in that area and outweighs, you know, is we win that fight. And until if you're scared of that, his addiction is always going to win. And he was able to maintain the house and stay in the house, and he's going to be there forever using drugs, because if he kicks him out, he's going to commit suicide.
This is the kid that dies in the bedroom that we always talk about.
Yeah, and that's what we told her. And so giving her the power to see that, hey, you're the one killing it.
Well, so Bob went on a big rant today on his Facebook page about people that die of addiction. What? So you're in this today.
Don't die.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I'm trying to start a don't die movement.
Yeah, and so what do you imagine there, and how does this dovetail into that?
The treatment industry is geared towards Minnesota model to treat people like you and me. We're supposed to go to Hazelden.
Right.
Treatment modality hasn't changed because 70% of the population is 18 to 26.
Right.
And these kids don't even know how to use drugs. They don't. They mix drugs. Well, I've been talking about with all drug addicts, if you watch that feed all the way through, there's an indoctrination amongst drug addicts of what is safe and what is unsafe, and that's not being practiced anymore. It really isn't. And that needs to come back, because these kids don't even know how dangerous fentanyl is. Because we've been lying to them, telling them marijuana is as dangerous as fentanyl. Mm-hmm. And they don't believe anything that comes out of any of our mouths. They don't.
Right.
And somebody needs to tell them, listen, there's pot and then there's fentanyl.
Yeah.
It's a fucking deadly disease, a deadly drug that I don't know whether you have the disease or not, but anybody can die of fentanyl. You take two of them, right? That the fentanyl thing, Drew, it's amazing. 46 kids in New Jersey died in one weekend. 46 kids.
How are they using it? Sublingually?
Well, I've been hearing about them shooting it now.
Yeah,
they're
shooting.
Well,
they're always shot. Transdermal
That's
shooting.
That's crazy.
Take the packets, suck on them.
Right, so I'm more interested in how to reduce the death rate, and I'm, you know, really got bothered by this kind of the reaction of like that whole some have to die so some can live. Like, these are not addicts like you and I, Art. Mm-hmm. That rule that everybody can die is for real addicts.
Yeah. Well, but
not 18-year-old kids stinking fentanyl that they bought at high school.
So here's the dovetail that I'm hearing, which is that the current treatment structure
needs to modernize.
Doesn't work.
Needs to be longer. Needs to be a year long.
Well,
it needs to have life skills, job training.
Right, those things we've begun to look.
Well, the insurance industry dictates treatment, and they're not going to pay for that.
Don't even. but what Art and Angie are saying is that there's another piece of this too. As long as these kids have progressed in a certain direction, the families also have gone in a certain way and need a lot more. Specific kinds of
Yeah, advice. I take it further. I mean, I get Bob. Bob seems to come from the perspective of the addict, and I get that. I think from what I've done in sober housing, what me and Amy have done in sober housing is we have learned to become the parents of addicts. And when I learned to become the parents addict, I really started taking a different perspective on what it feels like to sit and do nothing. And it sucks. And it isn't, I can say to anybody, oh yeah, don't just let your kid go, figure it out. But when my dog is missing for 20 minutes, I go nuts and I want to find my dog. And I can't even imagine then what that must feel like for a parent to have a 19-year-old kid just gone and then to try to sleep every night. And so we really take the perspective, and I don't know about LA. I don't know about down here. I know about up there and up. Where
up
we're
there
at
is Seattle in the Great Northwest.
Up there in King County in Seattle, and I'm not even talking about the street kids in Seattle. I'm talking about the upper middle class kids that found the pills and the heroin in high school and were headed on one trajectory of life and now are on a totally different one that doesn't seem to me they were ever headed for. It seems to me they were headed for college.
He's saying the same thing I've been saying for years. I wanted to be a drug addict from the time I was 13 years old. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
these kids had no intention of it, Drew.
No, yeah. I know.
And they're not sophisticated about it. Yeah. They're not interested.
They're just
in knowing
doing what the next
it.
Kid says. And so when we take that perspective, I'm
then
not
they get thrown into treatment, treated like they're real addicts.
Oh yeah, like they need to see a clinician or something.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah. I'm not. No, for us, it's not like the family is part of the problem or it's a minor family disease. For us, we really take the position that the family's the whole problem. Not even like I think the kids are more like clay. Like as long as you have the family doing exactly what needs to be done to make sure they're not. They're doing their own work and they're recovering from it and making sure that's all happening. The kids are like clay. You can work with them because you get the kid to have no options.
Well, I mean, you should know that in mental health services, they look at an adolescent not as the patient ever.
Oh, when I say kids, I always mean 18, 26.
But they have these addicts have delayed.
Right.
They get arrested in adolescence. So the rule is the patient family.
Yeah.
That's always been that way.
Yeah.
Identifiable patient.
The identified patient is not what you're treating. You're treating the patient family complex.
It's beautiful.
And it's just that's just an
axiom
in mental health.
And the standard way that we did it for 15 years was empower the addict with sobriety. Mm-hmm. And the whole dynamic of the family will change. They'll have to put somebody in the chair of the identifiable patient for the family system to continue to be dysfunctional. But these aren't those families, Drew.
Right, that's what I was going to say.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, we dealt with very different kinds of things.
See, when my son was going through his troubles, he was 17, and I had this disconnect and say, he's got the solid fundamentals of what life is about, and I'm only making things way worse. And I disconnected, and he had his trials and errors, and I helped here and there. Mm. But for the most part, he's never lived back in my home for 13 years. He's never been financially dependent on me on a monthly basis. He's made his way his way in the world, and I do believe I had those second thoughts like, is he going to die? Because I'm doing tough love. That's why the tough love, I was on the phone with
the lady. Let's do this. Let's specifically talk about our concepts about tough love. I think
well, they told me to take his computer out of his room. I said, you have to have a computer to do school. Yeah. And they said, well, what has he done to earn a computer? I was like, he's fucking 16 years old in 21st century America. Like, you know, and so, you know, that tough love as was identified traditionally.
All right, let's remind people to go to battlefieldaddiction.com, Battlefield Addiction. We'll have it up on the website as well.
This is more practical and less mechanical than tough love.
Yeah.
This is practicality, individual cases.
Well, it's kind of sounds like family coaching.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, is that what it is? That's
exactly.
Yeah.
Well,
but he's only one guy, just like.
No, I know. It's hard. But let's take a little break. Be right back. You know, I'm always happy to talk to you about our friends at Bergamot. They're the makers of a variety of supplements that use the extract from the bergamot citrus fruit, those polyphenols. That fruit is in Italy. These supplements act as a natural statin that may improve a number of cardiovascular conditions, as well as symptoms of the metabolic syndrome, which includes high blood pressure, high cholesterol, high blood sugar. As you know, I've been excited about the natural treatment since I first heard about it. I'm getting behind it. Science behind it is sound, and physicians throughout the world and cardiologists are actually using it. Now, the makers that brought you the formulation Bergamot NA, Bergamot Pro Plus, now bringing you Bergamot Sport. It provides all the same cardiovascular benefits, but has additional additives designed to aid athletes and those with a very, very active lifestyle. Bergamot Sport may help improve stamina and reduce recovery time and reduce muscle inflammation. Now, I've been taking Bergamot myself, and I suggest you talk to your physician to see if Bergamot Sport is right for you. And for a limited time, our listeners can save 10% on their order by entering the code Dr. Drew, D-R-D-R-E-W, at checkout. Again, that is D-R-D-R-E-W, all one word, at checkout, and you save 10% on your order of Bergamot. To order the Bergamot Sport for yourself, visit bergamot.com, Bergamot N-A, Bergamot, B-E-R-G-A-M-E-T.com, or click on the Bergamot banner on drdrew.com. Hey, we're back. Let's do this tough love conversation we're having. Which is,
so they told me to take my son's computer out of his room.
No, but hold on.
Take
hold
his
on.
TV out of his room.
Listen, what you do is not as important as how you do
they
it.
They were very focused on what you do.
Yeah. What do you think?
I think that addiction, all this, what's happened, at least, and I don't know about the rest of the country. I don't have the perspective, but from the perspective where we sit, the total problem is that each family has become untruthful and disconnected.
Okay.
In every, you know, the mom swallowing the lie, the father swallowing the lie, the father going over here, the kid going out, coming home with
but
the.
But that's all American families.
Sure, sure.
But this, well, addicts are really good at it.
But and so to reconcile that, it's truth and presence, and that's okay, what
so,
we
so
do.
So rigorous honesty.
So
everybody,
but to be truthful and present with each other, and then you say tough love, tough. Well, that's just boundaries.
Right.
And then, but you can't have a boundary and lead somebody away from the boundary if they don't trust you by being with them when they're not by the boundary. So it's important that a dad is with their kid in the good times, to be present with them, to sit, to have dinner. So when the kid does reach out to the boundary and get close to it, he can just give
him
a look.
How do you stop the shaming from happening? Because I know where you're at right there. I don't know if everybody's following. But I can get a kid to 3 or 4 months having dinner with the parents, and all of a sudden, it just goes up in smoke.
Oh, that's
it's
easy.
It's fucking crazy.
You tell them exactly what
the parents exactly what to say.
No. You tell them exactly. You teach a parent through what we do. You teach a parent that because a kid uses drugs, that's just a strategy for his to change the current moment. So the kids just, and then you teach the parents that they do the same thing, and then you show the parents that they do the same thing, and then they're no different than their kid. They use something else. And if you let them know and get them to a point of compassion that they see they're the same as their kid, they're doing something else. You eat, you watch too much TV, you workaholic, or whatever
the
you're doing.
The kid says this to the parents?
I'm saying it to the parents.
Oh.
And by the time me and Angie get done teaching these parents and taking them through these solution meetings every Thursday night where we talk about this stuff, and we say, how are you alike your addict? What is the same things you do with them? And they get to a point of compassion and understanding with addiction that they don't think it's some weird thing that their kid has. They think that it's just something that they do in a different way. And then there's no shame to that, because it's just, that's what it is.
And I will add that, thank God, I learned this 3 years ago, because at that time I was in the tough love mentality. I thought I was doing it right with the tough love.
How did you do that?
How did I do tough love?
Yeah.
I just waited for him to call, and right, he never did.
Detach from him. Did you tell him?
He couldn't come to my house.
But did you tell him?
Yes.
And how'd you tell him?
You have to leave.
You know,
he was on the streets.
Were you
when
angry?
He would call. Yes.
Okay. That's not tough love. Tough love has to be with deep compassion and love. Deep compassion. It kills me. I love you. but my keeping here is going to kill you.
Well, I think
so. You must leave.
Okay.
And that breaks my heart. I love you so much that I'm willing to go through the pain of doing this. And I have a support group over here.
That's exactly what she learned.
Yeah. That's what he taught me. Yeah. So my
because doing it with angry is just traumatic.
See how strangely we both were tough love coached, and it wasn't what you're describing.
I know.
Mine that's what was people details. People of get like it so wrong.
People get it so deeply wrong. Well, they do it out of anger and resentment and desperation and fury and blah 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 blah. Everything about them. It's not about the parent.
How could you do this to me?
Yes. I'm in pain. I don't give a shit what you're in.
Yeah.
You love this person. You have to do this to save their life.
And it starts with teaching them about addiction, though, and teaching them why it's just a simple strategy that they're applying, not something they. It's not a problem I had. It's a strategy I used. And if you can let them know, it's just a strategy he's using right now. And teach them through our workshops, through everything we teach. By the time they get an understanding of addiction, they see a much more simple view of it. And it's not so personal to them. You know, and that's the main thing, is making it not such a personal thing to the family.
I like that.
Because if they've taken it, but that's where it came from, was me doing this. Man, when I opened up sober housing, being a recovering addict, me and Amy had the sober houses, and we're opening up, and we're thinking they're getting high in our houses as personal vendetta to us, you know? And so I would be driving at 2 o'clock in the morning to go yell at an addict, you know, how could you do this to me? What are you doing in my house? You know,
there you go. The evolution of art right there.
And so I had to get to a point where I understood it, where I didn't understand my own addiction. That's the thing. I didn't understand. I thought it was my fault too. For a long time, for 6 months, 8 months, a year. It was years before I realized, oh, shoot, I was unconscious. I didn't really even have a choice. Like, I did what my brain told me to do, and I listened. And I didn't have a way out of that because nobody gave me another alternative. And it got too loud in my brain, and the pressure got too hot, and I had to use. And so I didn't, until I understand my own addiction, I couldn't be compassionate about somebody else's. You know, I see people recovering addicts all the time that I see in meetings or whatever, and it always baffles me because they'll come to our solution meeting and they'll have a brother or a sister that's still using, and they'll sit with anger and go, I just don't understand why he doesn't choose recovery like me.
Well, codependency is often a primary problem in drug addiction.
Yeah, but they think that so you chose recovery, and they, yeah. And I go, well, did you have any money when you quit getting high? And they go, no, I was out of money. And I said, well, how did you choose it then? It's like saying I chose to stop because I ran into a wall. You know, you didn't make a choice.
We would amuse ourselves with the reasons that people say they came to treatment.
Yeah.
And Sasha and I would make sport out of it. We'd go, why are you here today? Oh, I'm sick and tired of being sick. I finally came to this. And we're like, really? Tell us more. Sick and tired? And I said, oh, how about the court document here where the judge sent you right from court? Did that have anything to do with it? Anything at all? I'm also sick and tired. There's that the court thing.
I didn't have to come. I chose to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's, you know, I learned that in Cry Help, Drew. Old gangster walked up on me in the shower area.
Yeah.
And he said, you know what, Holmes? I'm tired of hearing you bitch and complain about how you have to be here because the court's told you, because the court ordered here. And I was all scared of him. He's a tough guy, been in prison a lot. And I was like, but they did. And he goes, no, the judge gave you a choice, go to jail or go to Cry Help. And I was like, yeah, I totally forgotten that option.
By the way, why didn't you introduce me to that guy so we could get him into our team?
It's probably Danny Trejo.
Could have been.
It was a guy that knows him, I'm sure. But as a parent, I'm really interested because I talk to parents all the time and I don't know what to tell them. And maybe I'm telling them wrong. I just think that we're talking about 24 and 26-year-old and 30-year-old grown adults. This society is making children out of people till they're what age?
I know.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, but I think that part of the problem is these kids' top is no different than their bottom. I mean, we're not
I like that.
You know, we're not dealing with a group of kids that had jobs, houses, cars, checkbooks.
That's so, what I always say. The Minnesota model, just so you know, that's Hazelden basically invented it. What drug treatment is, what we do at ALO, it's everywhere, basically every treatment center. What it's for is grown, full-functioning adults who have lost or is starting to lose the three principles of existence that they love. Their hobbies and interests, their work, and their love and family. And until you have established those, it will not work. The Minnesota model will not work for them. They've never achieved anything.
Yeah.
They have dreams of it, though, but usually. But now they don't even have that.
They have delusions of it.
Sometimes delusions. But now he can't even get them to say that there's anything they want to be doing.
Mm-hmm. Well, right? The kid that died the other day, I had a showdown with him about 2 months ago. And I said, dude, you're going to die. I'm not just saying that. You cannot use drugs the way you're using them. He had OD'd twice at my sober living and, you know, eyes rolling back in the head. And he said, well, I don't care. And I said, every junkie says they don't care, but you do care. And he goes, Bob, I don't really care.
Oh, my God.
And I just...
So what would you tell that parent if that's the mom?
He was 22 years old.
If they're really, really kids, really hopeless without...
He never had his own apartment.
So can I tell you a story?
Yeah, please.
So Angie just called me a year ago, Amy. We've been doing this thing together for 5 years now. We got sober 6 years ago. And a year ago, Amy had a relapse. Amy is a meth user. And her relapse culminated in a meth-induced schizophrenia or meth-induced psychosis. And... you know, after a couple of days back home in the house, she had a suicide attempt. And luckily, in time, I found Amy in the garage, and we were able to get her down and get her off to treatment. And here she sits now, a year later with us. And, you know, at that point, there was not... Amy didn't know. She thought, you know, I'd love to let her explain.
Sure,
but I thought that, you know, I'm sure at that point, she thought she wanted to die. You know, I mean, at that point, that's what she thought was
well. If you know, if you can put people somewhere for 6 months, they'll be a lot better. But you can't do that.
So we had a kid that's in another mother calling with her son, and she didn't have hope. She said that, you know, she thinks he wants that right now, and we were able just to tell her the story of Amy and tell her that, you know, just because the drugs are telling somebody they want to die. Mm-hmm. You know, a person doesn't have any. Their brain's gone at that point, you know. And so,
let Amy tell it. Go ahead. Well, so, when did you regain hope?
Right in the hospital that night in the hospital. Mm-hmm. As soon as I kind of came out of it, I mean, I just was like, I couldn't believe that I was in that moment. I mean, it was just unreal because I didn't want to die. There was no way I wanted to die.
Was there
no
a lot
way.
Of shame about being sober and relapsing?
Oh, yeah.
See, we got to remove that.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. That's no, it was maybe not shame.
But it sounds like you were psychotic, you know, though. In the,
I was.
In
I'd
the
been
psychosis,
up for days.
Right. In the psychotic state, you sometimes believe you're killing yourself so you don't get harmed by the aliens that are coming or whatever. Or no. in an agitated state, in a manic state, just do stuff impulsively.
Well, I didn't want to do it
no,
again.
No, but people will beat themselves up. Remember, a friend of ours got 8 years, and he told me he got so again, he kept trying and trying and screwing up, and he said, not until I have 8 years, 3 months, and 17 days will I feel better. And I was like, dude, what are you talking about? Because he had had 8 years, should, yeah, 4 months, and 16
better.
days.
He should feel better about 1 hour and 1 day.
But it's something that happens inside the addict brain that's had sobriety.
Yeah, but guess what? The disease takes advantage of everything. Mm-hmm. So that's a liability that a recovering person has. So, boom, the disease takes advantage of it.
But Amy was convinced that she was hurting people too badly, right? And that, I mean, I read the letter, and she was thinking that she was going to be better off. It was going to be better for her son and better for me if she was gone, because she really...
After a few days of using? Come on!
It had been months.
Months?
It had been months. I had hidden it.
So you had hidden it.
I hid it from him for a couple of months, and then when it came out, I think we tried to manage it in house for a week or two. He went away. He was going away on a vacation down to Pendleton, and I couldn't get him out the door fast enough on Monday morning because I had some work to do.
Yeah.
And they were going down to get him by Wednesday. They were having to come back, and
so
I
by
took
the
off.
Time. By the time Art found out about it till when you got sober again, how long was that? Two weeks? 2 weeks?
Yeah, about two
See
weeks.
See that? There you go.
He believed the first week that I was going to be okay. Mm-hmm. And so he went away
Thanks
he was gone.
Thanks for being so honest with us.
Well, we tried to get the whole staff and everybody in our staff and everybody around us and our whole team that helps people to help Amy. But
How did that feel? Not so great.
Yeah, so we told the whole staff and we told everybody, and we tried to keep it, you know, because we'd done a relapse before with Amy the year prior. And so this time it was like, well, we don't want to do the whole treatment deal again. But, you know, inevitably we got her on our plane and got her out of there.
Yeah.
But, you know, I mean, at that point, so whenever I tell a family, whenever a family comes and says their kid doesn't want to live or whatever, I mean, it doesn't matter. That's like your kid saying he's going to be whatever. Anytime these kids are talking, they don't know what they're talking about.
No, when they're in it, but you're dealing with them months later, months and months later in the program, doing well, and
they
still
don't see a lot of opportunities. See, one thing you've got up in the Great Northwest is a lot of good job opportunities. We don't have that here in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. We don't. Yeah. It's service industry jobs, $8 an hour. Costs $1,800 to have a one-bedroom apartment. I mean, this is horrible for kids. And we import thousands of them every year to come from Illinois, come from Ohio to treatment in L.A. And, of course, anybody that comes here is going to want to stay here, yeah. Right?
Yeah.
But I'm very much about get back to your community. There's more opportunity in your community probably, unless you live in the Rust Belt. There's probably more opportunity in your community you came from than there is in Los Angeles for you. Kids don't want to hear that.
See, and I hear you say that, and I think we just need to talk to their parents. We need to get their parents on board. And
tell them what.
You're validating. Well, yeah. You're validating no jobs. You're validating reasons for them to continue in this. And I say we need to meet their family so we can get everybody on the same team. We can teach their family.
It's just a narrative. It's just a narrative.
In the case of, I'm talking about thousands of, probably, I don't know the numbers, but it's got to be tens of thousands of kids from all over the United States come to Malibu, West Los Angeles, Southern California, Laguna, all in Southern California for treatment, and they don't want to go home. We don't even meet their parents. Their parents aren't anywhere around
That's
here.
That's a problem.
And that is a big problem, but the insurance industry does that, Drew.
I don't know. You're doing it. What are you talking about? What do you mean?
What?
You're not meeting the family. What do you mean the insurance?
There's no treatment centers. I'm telling you. I was in New Orleans, Louisiana. You know how many treatment centers there are there? Three in New Orleans.
Yeah.
Three. That's crazy.
So what is the big picture? What's the solution?
We should take 100 of the 3,000 we have here and move them to New Orleans.
So how do we bottle this? What you guys do? How do we spread it? Because
it would have to model after the 12-step thing. It would have to be.
Well,
a
I was
going to
say my you know, whenever I've been involved with families that do Al-Anon well, this is what happens to them. Exactly what you're describing.
Yeah.
And so there is a program out there that's free and available to everybody, but no one does it. And it's a little you got to find the right program through Al-Anon. But if you get the right sponsor and the right group and the right support, exactly what you're describing is what's supposed to happen.
But somebody has to take the interest like Art does to coach, and they're
not
doing that.
I understand
that.
They're not doing that. I get that. But that's what the sponsor is supposed to do, or the coffee group or whatever.
I'm in Al-Anon. I can tell you. It's about you. It's not about your kid. It's about you. It's about why you're having these feelings about your spouse or loved one or kid being on drugs or drunk or lying to you or whatever. And the steps are the same as in AA.
Do you have a sponsor?
Yeah, I did for years.
And does he sit and meet with you? And
yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Well, I think that misses some of the...
But it's not about my kid or my interactions with
So it doesn't
patients.
Help you manage
it's
the
It's not
kid.
What they're talking about.
Okay.
They're
okay.
talking about the real practical hour by hour, okay. what do I do right now?
Got it. So it's really
coaching. I think it actually starts... Well, that's get coaching the kid into treatment, but once you get the kid into treatment, that's when the work starts. And the work, I mean, is to understand that just because somebody uses drugs, that's just ambition. I mean, to be a drug user just means you have ambition. And that you're just more ambitious than the person that goes to the mall and maybe buys the shoes to feel differently. I don't see it as any different. And if I can get a family all on board that they're each using their own thing, and then they can have compassion for each other and see that they're all the same. Everybody's using. And if you're not using prayer, meditation, some type of practice that you're using, then you're using something with consequences. And just because you smoke cigarettes and you think that's different than your kid using drugs, well, you're going to die just at a later date. That doesn't mean anything. And so if you get that common bond that, whoa, we were all untruthful and we all weren't present with each other, and I swallowed your
that's
lies.
That's a breakdown of the identifiable patient system is what he just said is
that.
A breaking down of that.
And so we start with that.
But unless somebody's overseeing it constantly, it's just going to go back to the way that it was.
Go ahead.
Well, you guys got to make this grow nationally. It can't just be in Seattle.
Yes.
I'm trying to,
yes.
You know, what I would say, I say it all the time. I think rehab has polluted the waters of Alcoholics Anonymous in Southern California. I think that It has polluted a lot of psychobabble, and therapy has polluted the Al-Anon environment. We need a purification of the systems that are funded for free, rather than new organizations.
Purification?
A purification. Like, get it back to its, like we say, back to the basics.
Yeah, yeah.
Rehab needs to be back to the basics, not all this highfalutin nonsense. Back to the basics. AA needs to get back to the basics. You wouldn't believe how much psychobabble you hear in AA these days. And it's only because I live
Barry
here.
Crazy. Right?
I know.
Oh, poor Barry.
That was 10 years ago. Imagine what it's like now.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is rehabs. Rehab speak, rehab.
It, well, to be fair, though, there's been more mental
illness.
And we're
personally responsible for rehab, Drew, so we have to do something.
There's been more mental illness in the recovering community, though, too, though.
It's a
That's the other part. Yeah. Oh, my goodness. So I'm getting overwhelmed trying to think about all this.
Well, at least start the L.A. chapter.
Yeah. Addiction. Go to addiction, battlefieldaddiction.com. Can people be of service there or be a, get them?
Well, right now we have a venue wherever you tell them, man. Just tell them about the solution groups Thursday night. And
every Thursday night?
Oh, we have a Zoom. We can Zoom in on our meetings. So we have. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so we have weekly solution groups every Thursday, 4 o'clock and 7 o'clock in Seattle.
They have to have it two times a night. Mm-hmm. Just that's what I noticed.
Yeah, because
there's so many families.
There's so many people. And so we also Zoom. We use the app Zoom. It's like Skype. And so we have a lot of people. Gosh, we have about 35, 40 people a week that Zoom in. And they're from out of state. And they Zoom in and listen in. The best way we can help a family is through the private consultation that I was telling you about earlier. And that's where we can identify the holes in the boat and help them with the next right move. What's in what order do we need to cut off the resources to push that addict into the corner so they're left with no other option but to choose recovery. And then we walk them. So Art sets them with a plan. Art just has this gift. He's got this ability to be able to put himself in the addict's shoes without ever meeting the addict and pinpoint exactly what needs to be done. And then I'm the follow-up, and I walk families through. They're calling me, and I'm helping them through the whole process.
Sure,
in the meantime, in the meantime, they're coming to our weekly solution groups and plugging in to get that support. They're coming to our monthly workshops to get that support.
You know what I just thought? Mm-hmm. You know what you could do is if you had an affordable sober living for $500 or $600 or $700 a month, which is what I think you have, right?
Yes.
Just have the parents pay for a year, and he needs to be here a year, she needs to be here a year. That's it.
Yes. Well, we tell them that. We tell them that they're probably, you know, every dad wants to come in with the hopes that this is going to be about 2 months. My kid's going to have the new job, and you know, and
that's
I want
the dad
you
thing
know,
I was talking
yeah,
about.
They all the that's their dads. Either we get two types of dads. We get the one that just wants his kid to get his shit together, and that comes with a job and a car, and he needs to hurry up. And then we get the dad that's kind of just broke down and emotional as a mother, and he
that's the one I'm talking about. That's the LA dad.
Yes, we get some of those.
And
so we have tech industry dad,
and we kind of one dad we the broke down one we push back and go do your thing. We got this, and then kind of and then the checked out dad we bring him. And we bring them involved.
That makes sense.
And they all come into the group room, the solution room, and their arms are crossed, and they don't want to be there. But by the end, they're involved.
Sure.
And so the solution group start it all. It's the kickoff. A family walks in, and it starts their journey. And after the solution group, the Angie gets with them. And by the way, this is done for a small donation to Battlefield of $150.
And the consultation.
The consultation. And Angie does literally like 25 hours of work with each family minimum to get them wherever we get them.
And the you made a lot of the using of whether it's tobacco or alcohol or whatever by everyone in the family. That's what's called affect regulation. That's you know that we have
food.
Yeah, that currently we have a very strange phenomenon in this country, which is people don't have the proper early attachments, so they don't come with a regulated affect system. So they have to reach outside of their body to regulate the internal world. That's not normal. Mm-hmm. That's not how it's been through the last 1,000 years. I mean, maybe in Highlands of Scotland when they were being genocidally assaulted, maybe it was. But that's a sort of a trend that's been coming for the last 20 years.
And why is that? Because I think that we're more aware.
Why is
the attachment not happening? Because we're more aware of child rearing and child development than ever before.
Well, I don't want to blame working moms. That's what Amy said. It's really that we don't have good models of attachment. They've been devolving. Families were very much sort of there aren't dads around in a lot of situations. Mm-hmm. So moms are harried and out of control and trying to survive, and so they can't focus and provide the attachment the way they need to. And we went through a couple decades where families were just one of the options that humans had evolved, and there are probably other ways of doing this, and so they no value put in child rearing, the real child rearing part, the anxiety and getting them into the workplace and maybe making them be a perfect extension of yourself. Well, that okay, everyone signed up for, but the actual meeting of the child needs, which is just being there, and no one had time for that.
And sitting there, you always do the thing. Sitting there, you're frustrated. I can see that you're frustrated.
Just be there.
The new version is, my child is frustrated. I need to distract you.
Take it away.
Well, that's because that's again because we're unregulated. We can't tolerate the child's frustration. Yeah. It makes us feel bad. So it's got to stop in the child, as opposed to just being present and letting the child. And by the way, offering the child some soothing affects alongside of, or just at least present, being
strategies
present and being attuned, just letting your body be an antenna that attunes to them, and that they will. That's a model for affect regulation. That's how we build that as an infancy, and we reattune. That's what we reaccess. That's what a sponsor is. Just somebody sitting there saying, "Me too."
Yeah.
Yeah.
There you go. Well,
but they need more now because they can't have to build a function in the world. That's the part that Bob's getting frustrated with.
No, I'm not frustrated. I think they got a bum rap.
Yeah,
I agree with
bum
you. Deal.
And there's another piece too. No one ever talks about. They have too many options. Right? When you ask them, what do they want to do? They're like, it's too much. Look, I'm going to go on the web. Let me see. And there's all this literature that shows that if humans have more than about 6 to 9 options, they become paralytic. They can't make a choice. And think about trying to find a career path today, Bob. I mean, what are you going
to
do?
I was a musician and led to being a drug counselor. I didn't have much choice.
Well, you weren't making it. You were choosing as you went, right?
I was telling Johnny today, I don't know how this happened.
Can you relate to what I'm talking about, Johnny? There's too many choices.
As a college student right now, like I know what you guys mean by feeling lost, But luckily, I had the parents, like I had that dad,
he had the get your shit together dad.
Yeah.
Always make sure like
can't hear him, so we got to give him that. Yeah, real quick. Go ahead.
Let's interview Johnny. He's a millennial here.
Yeah, go ahead, Johnny.
Yeah,
tell him the story of what your parents said when you turned 18.
Oh yeah, so when I. Right, baby, before you turn 18, they're like, "All right, we're gonna cut you off. No funds, no nothing."
Were you using? Were you?
No, I was not using. I'm a traditional normal Mexican family. Girl. Like, yeah. You got that's it. So, like, right away, I was like, "Oh crap! Like, what do I do? I don't know. There's so many things to do. Like, I don't know where I'm gonna go. I feel lost." So, like how he was, I was kind of going finding my way. Like a lot of my friends, like they're about like 3rd year, 4th year in college. They still are undecided in their majors.
Yeah.
They don't have a direction or any way to go. And
I saw the movie The Founder the other day. We went to about Ray Kroc.
Yeah.
And they had just example after example of people just going, I'm selling pianos and I'm selling this. I'm just getting by. I gotta get food on the table. I gotta figure it out. And they weren't making choices. They were just doing what they could do to get food on the table.
Right? That's what I feel my life was like.
Right. That's right.
There was not
choices.
They don't,
food's on the table for these guys. They don't have to worry about that. So you live for $1 a day, no problem. They got to figure out what they want to do with their life, which is great on one hand, but it becomes confusing and paralyzing on another.
Well, that's the hardest question that we have to answer. What is my kid going to do next? They always want that answer. They want it, and I think it's for them,
Of course,
but
not for the kid.
I tell it, the most valuable thing that we can teach and what we work on the most with parents and with everybody is sit still. Sit
exactly
still.
What I just said.
Yes.
Right? Just
I want to teach a kid to sit still. Yeah. I don't want them to come. Treatment is about teaching a kid to sit still. Yeah. They say they got to go do this, mm-hmm. and this. And they always tell me the 10 things they need to go do. And then they leave and I go, "What'd you do?" And they go, "I got high."
Of course.
I know. Yeah. I know. But the ones that we want to teach them to sit still. Just do the dishes.
Yeah.
Just sweep. Go to bed. Make your bed. That's treatment. Treatment for us, that's what we're working on with the aloe guys.
Well, that's the treatment, aloe's the traditional place, back, a throwback kind of, right? The newest, about 5 years ago, I had a client in Promises Malibu. I drove all the way out there. I told the council, I'll be out on Tuesday in the afternoon. I drive out there, and the guy is not there. I go, where the fuck is he? He's in it. He was like day 17. I go, "Well, where is he?" And they go, "Oh, he had a dentist appointment." I said, "A fucking dentist appointment?
What are you talking about?
You know what that is. Yeah. You know what that is.
He manipulated.
Of course.
Because
you know he's just a big RX sign over the desk.
But the system used to be unmanipulatable.
Huh. Yeah.
And now it was like, he needs to go. He is going to the dentist.
We're working on it with Joe. At Aloe, we're building a program to take. The first question I asked, I've never been down to Malibu. I came down to fly down here to meet Jared and Evan because they told me they were great guys and they were doing the deal. And so I came down to talk to them. And that was the first question I asked him is, how are you guys addressing the entitlement issue? And
well, that's sort of what you're talking about too, Bob.
Yeah, and so that's what we're working on with our program at Aloe. We're working on addressing the entitlement issue, and that's and taking that away. You know, all the phones and I still cannot figure out why a cell phone is necessary in any treatment center. I really can't figure out why anybody would have one. And so we're taking that away and working on that program down there to take away that entitlement.
That's good. Well. Appreciate
it's a crazy world.
Yeah, it's very interesting. It is.
But don't you love that they took action at all?
Yes,
this,
I love all of it. I'm fascinated by
and
it.
Frustration.
Listen, we like just the way they're coming up with solutions. It's what you're asking for is come up with new models and new ways of doing things.
It's the same as those moms that did the movie down in Orange County. Remember?
Yeah, it was a long time ago.
It was so sad. Yeah. We had this one doctor down in Orange County. I don't know if you guys heard about Orange County south of here. This woman killed, like, how many kids? She went to prison eventually.
Yeah.
But, like, a whole neighborhood of kids, like, different mothers had their kids lost to this one doctor that was just selling Oxycontin to however
no,
much.
No, she wasn't selling Oxycontin. What? She was doing consults and pain management, and who am I to say what the pain is, and just prescribing stuff.
And so ridiculous number, like 418 kids died of drugs that were prescribed by her. And so they made a movie about it, which drew the DA's attention, which got her prosecuted. How crazy is that? Mom standing up.
Still out there. I'm telling you, it's still a problem.
Oh, it's out there. But now it's not coming from Big Pharma. It's coming from China.
It's not coming. It's coming from my peers. They are prescribing it. Mm-hmm. It's not about Big Pharma. It's about doctors who believe patients, problem number one. Mm-hmm. And then number two, think opiates are a good solution for ongoing pain. And three...
Are you in pain,
thank
too?
You.
Hang on. And three, don't know how to do an addiction history. They have no idea. And, you know, we, thank God, taught those students. We had medical students for how many years? Like 7 or 8 years?
Yeah.
We got a few of them. And those were good. We got that group at least sort of understanding what
you
this is.
You know who gets it nowadays? Emergency room
doctors,
because
they
see it every night. So,
but they tend to divert. They tend to dodge it because it's too hard.
No, but my thing is now the genie is out of the bottle in America. Every American kid has tasted opiates. I'm convinced of it. Every American kid has tasted opiates. The genie's out of the bottle. Now it's going to come in illicit ways so that the whole thing's a bad drug problem. It's not. It didn't come from doctors and Big Pharma. It's bad people and bad drug deals on the streets.
No, Dr. Mr. Sessions, the only bad drug is pot. Only bad or bad people do pot. That's what he said.
Oh, bad people?
Yeah, that's what he said. All right, listen. It's Battlefield Addiction. That's where I want everybody to go, battlefieldaddiction.com.
You guys are going to get inundated, and you can barely do what you're doing. Do you sleep at night?
Remind people. No. I know. I'm interested in the Zoom thing. You're going to get a lot of that. I may Zoom it myself just to see what's going on.
Let's Zoom it.
Because that to me, that's a next order solution, right? If we can get people access and you know, more involved.
That's a good start.
That's right. And again, thank you, Angie, Art, and Amy. We appreciate you guys being here. Also, our friends at Bergamet and at Bergamet Sport and our friends at National Assessment Foundation. Reminder, sign up for our email list, doctor.com/contact. And you go there. Don't forget to check out that Amazon banner for all your shopping needs. We can thank you for your support and hope to be hearing your comments on iTunes and check out your 5-star ratings there. Subscribe there at iTunes. Also want to thank, the very products that Bergamet has to offer. And I guess I'll.
Which one should I get on? Do you have them here today? Can I start?
Look
at Drew.
No, I'm thinking about your liver. I'm thinking about. I think
I need the testosterone.
Nah. Your hepatologist needs to. Okay. We need to double check with him. But I just think the Mega Pro is probably the one for you.
Okay.
So go to the website, check out their new products. And also, there's a buy one, get one free with a purple pouch. How about that, Susan? That's interesting. All right, everybody. Thank you so much for being here. Appreciate you guys coming all the way out for this. We appreciate it very, very much.
What did we learn today? Dr. Drew doesn't like fentanyl, the effects of fentanyl.
I hate fentanyl. I hate opiates generally. And I'm jealous of you all that seem to enjoy it so much.
That's just ridiculous.
But all the opiates tend to affect me badly, but fentanyl just really destroys me. I mean, like, destroys me for days and days. So, Johnny, thank you for being part of this little podcast. Yeah, appreciate you all, and we'll see you next time.
Cool.